It's my privilege as a sort of veteran of Holden Forums over the last few years to introduce this one. It's a little bit out of the beaten track for Holden Forums because we don't often have the kind of privilege that I think awaits us this evening of hearing from and I hope getting to interact with and dialogue with Pete Perro. This is Dr. Albert Pete Perro. You've run into him already. He was the black preacher who was getting his head together at the beginning of the service tonight, sitting off to the side, had to be wakened. This is Pete's first time at Holden. And those of us who have been to Holden many times are absolutely ecstatic that he's finally made it up the mountain, because we know that he's been up lots of other mountains and he's come back to tell us about them in ways that have been moving and stretching for all of us. Pete Perro is professor of systematic theology and cross-cultural affairs, whatever those are, at Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. He's one of the most eminent black theologians that the United States has to offer. In fact, in my book, he's one of the most eminent theologians in the United States. His work in cross-cultural investigation deals not only with the rainbow of cultures in the United States, but particularly with the African and Afro-American and American experience. He worked with, was part of the ministry of, and has carried out large portions of the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King, and continues to interpret that most rich of 20th century theologian activists for our present time. And I think it's some of that work that Pete wants to share with us tonight. And I, as I always do, am looking forward to it mightily. So I think we should have a sort of formal welcome up the mountain for Pete Perro.
Thank you very much, Jody. Jody and I are long time friends and struggle for human rights and justice and so forth. And when nobody else understood anything that I was about, Jody always lent an ear and seemed to understand things, I would dare say, in confession form, sometimes faster than many of my black colleagues. So that should give you a little hint about his personality and his character and the blessings that the Lord has given him. But there is a massive agenda in front of us, and I thought about this and said to myself, I would like to really stay within the framework of a half hour, if that's at all possible. Because there is something to say relative to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and what that theology has to say to us today in 1987. It is extremely challenging. One of our colleagues, Jim Cohn, is just putting together finishing touches of a book, if he has not produced that already, on the understanding of King versus and or Malcolm X and what that's all about. So these are exciting times for reflection of the faith. I've been an activist most of my life and have not lived in the United States at a period of time when you are given time to think. Now, usually we're out there making moves on things because we don't, you know, you're not given too much time to think about it. You just go on and do it. So we're taking advantage of this opportunity to reflect. And the things that I'll share with you, I hope they will be provocative to any discussions that you might have. I am suggesting, from my experience with King's theology, that the material is somewhat provoking. It will cause you to want to talk about this at other points in your life. So if that then follows, which it usually does with most folk, then don't feel frustrated since we only have a little clump of time here, because we'll be here until Thursday, I think it is. And with some of you might get a chance to share a few things here and there as we go along over the days, okay? So let's just hop right into it. I'd like to begin by giving you a theme. If you got a pencil and you want to jot something down, I'd really be happy to see you do that, because that's the way this material is. I jot things down for myself, and I go over them again and again. I go back to them, and new things come to me after I take another look at them. But if not, then try to get your memory cap on and hopefully handle it that way. I'd like to entitle this thing, after thinking about it, The Mystery of the Meaning of Our Times. Okay, with intentionality, I'm saying it that way. The mystery of the meaning of our times. And I'd like to utilize two major illustrative models to get at that, and then move into certain components of King's theology, and then cut it loose and have us discuss it. The Mystery of the Meaning of Our Time. I'd like to begin that by saying that our histories are inextricably tied together. That almost comes right out of King's orientation. We are tied to a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one affects the other. So our histories, you know, whether we like it or not, our histories are tied together. So we have one common destiny. And that destiny, most of us in a religious way know about. I tease some of my friends and colleagues and with this that we have debates over whether philosophically the human being thinks linearly or cyclically. We have major debates about that. And my comical way of handling those things, especially when it gets hot in there, and faculty knows I'm real good with that. You know, I just pour water on them because they take themselves too seriously. And that is this, that whether or not you think A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, which is the Western way of thinking, everybody's taught like that here, or whether you think in a cyclical process like most of the third world people do, coming straight out of Africa. Whichever way the debate ends, religiously in the Christian faith, we came from God and we're going back whether you like it or not. That's the way I would put it. So that means a cyclical process for me. So we are then tied to this single destiny together. That is to say, our histories are tied together. So to get at the point of the mystery of the meaning of our times with that backdrop or that presupposition opened up so that you know what I'm talking about, namely that our histories are tied together. Black people many years ago raised a question. They said to themselves, who shall we now be? Now that we have just decided that we shall no longer be slaves. Now, they didn't have a meeting with whites and say, come now, let us reason together. They just made a declaration of intent. And they raised that question, who shall we now be now that we have decided that we will no longer be slaves? Now, when they made that statement, that question and answer to that question raised a correlative question of our white male colleagues. And that question that they had to ask themselves is, who shall we now be now that we can no longer be masters? Now notice we haven't talked to each other yet. And I'm submitting to you that that's how, in case any of you wanted to know, even in the scientific enterprise now, they are acknowledging that that is how social transformation occurs. Okay? Why is that so important? Because most of us believe that if things are going to change, we have to convince the power people to change. And I'm suggesting to you that's why things don't change. Okay? Now, this information is also dangerous for you to know. So everything that that is recreated by black people, for example, when black people recreate things like the sacredness of private property, black people, for example, saw that the earth is the Lord's. And, of course, that's quite biblical. But when they saw that and made a move on it, the question became, why should we not then have access to it since the earth is the Lord's? By the way, you can't afford to take the Bible too seriously. I mean that sincerely. So I always tell people, especially when I was a pastor, I would say to them, why don't you spend 40 days and 40 nights with Jesus and find out where he's going before you join this church, because you might not want to go. And we need that much time up here in the mountains to find out where Jesus is going, because I'm serious, you just might not want to go. So black people then started making those assertions. And in doing so, they were challenging the self-understanding of America. So the mystery then, the mystery of the meaning of our times, the mystery of a people walking out of slavery and challenging a people to a new vision is certainly the presentation of this brief scaled-down story, Montgomery, Alabama, Rosa Parks. And it has been said here before within the discussions by Cheryl Stewart and others of the women that indeed women are always starting something, you know, in a beautiful, facetious way. But Montgomery, Alabama, Rosa Parks, that thing is filled with symbolism. You see, some of these workshops, we've been talking about symbolism. But it is filled with symbolism. And some of the things that happen in there, in Hyde Park, the Hyde Park schools are noted, it has been noted that it is the world capital of theology. From a black perspective and in the black idiom, we would say we got some bad dudes in Hyde Park. That intellectual enterprise is a monster over there. But when these people did what they did, these little old lowly, nameless, faceless black folk, when they did what they did, this thing challenged all of the analysis of the apparatuses that we have in Hyde Park, to say nothing about the academic disciplines across the country. All of the sciences were just stupefied with all of their predictable data. They could not figure out this mystery that happened in Montgomery, Alabama. Indeed, in 1987, they still have not figured it out. 1955, the mystery of what we call now the black experience. Two things happen showing how redemption and equality dance together. Now get that one down too, because that's black folk refusing to separate things. It is demonstrated here unequivocally how redemption and equality dance together. They cannot be separated, in other words. The people put forth what they were willing to do for freedom. Now, see, that's what folk have to do. And you do this anyway unconsciously. And see, if I keep pushing you, pretty soon you will register to me in some peculiar ways what you will be willing to do in the name of freedom. So they posited what they would indeed be willing to do for freedom. Now, you can find all this recorded so you don't think I'm trying to trick you, in a book entitled Stride Toward Freedom, authored by Martin Luther King Jr. himself. These lowly people had three demands for the bus company. Some of you all may be, you know, familiar with that. They had three demands for the bus company. And little did they know that those three demands would be injecting new meaning into the totality of civilization. Now, in the style of the black preacher, I must say, I don't believe y'all heard what I said. See, because it is that kind of stuff that stupefies all of the apparatus in the scientific academic enterprise, because you can't analyze it. See? So they had three little demands, and those three little demands ended up ejecting, once again, new meaning into the totality of the civilization. Therefore, according to W.B. Du Bois and a lot of other folk that you can read, after then struggling with the conductor on the bus, you all with me with the story? Mm-hmm. After struggling with the passengers on the bus, and finally after getting a seat on the bus, then somebody in the peanut gallery said, "Where is the bus of America going?" Isn't that interesting? And notice how I said that. Where is the bus of America going? Now folk perceive that they have to be the conductor of the bus. See, this is awesome stuff now. And see, inside of this mystery and symbolism, you all ought to be picking up something. Now we have to be the bus driver, in short. Well, as one story, see, I'm just cut it loose there. We could really build this, because black preachers love to tell stories. Boy, we'd be telling this story for 2 hours. And you'd be sitting on the edge of the seat, but we had to cut loose. Here's another quick module before we run into this other material directly of King. And that is our good friend Jesse L. Jackson. You all know him? Okay. This story begins with a colleague and a brother by the name of Lieutenant Robert Goodman. You all ever heard, remember that name? It's kind of vague now because he's sliding back. Lieutenant Robert Goodman. Naval Air Force. Graduate of Annapolis, this brother had a vision of equality that was cut off now. Notice now, it was cut off from redemption. He had a vision of equality. Don't miss that now. See, because there are a whole lot of folk now that are moving toward equality. But the problem, you got some problems when it's cut off now from redemption or from transformation. With a transforming vision of equality, it can be nothing but destructive once you leave redemption out. And Brother Goodman was a primary illustration of that. Robert Goodman got equality, and he was equal to murder people, and he had the approval of this nation to be antisocial in his behavior, because he forgot what the old black folk taught him, that you cannot separate equality from redemption, therefore social transformation. He forgot that. He was just after equality. And he got equal with all the white folks. He became a fabulous jet pilot to kill folks. Okay, do y'all hear what I'm trying to say? All right then. Jesse Jackson became a mystery. Running his fanny over there in the middle of that hornet's nest and ain't nobody asked him. Do y'all hear? Even y'all was probably talking about him. Know some black folks was talking about him in Chicago. But Jesse has always understood something about how transformation works. See, he ain't got the whole picture. He just got some glimpses at it through Martin King. That's why this thing is so important. And he is a mystery to himself. See? That's the way this thing operates, though. You know you're tied up in a mystery. And so when they got back, this is the report they gave us when they went over there to see Assad about Lieutenant Robert Goodwin's behavior. Jesse said they sat down when they got there and prayed, and they fasted, and they played bid whist in that order. Because that's the way black folk do things. And oddly enough, you all, do you all know that Assad understood that? Because that's the way they act. See, when the United States government gets in trouble with them other countries overseas, they call on black preachers because we act like they act and we can communicate with them. Okay? That's the truth. I kid you not. So it is in that whole process and in that whole story that then Jesse encounters Assad, and Assad asks him, "What do you have to trade off?" And he said, "We ain't got nothing to trade off. We came here asking for your mercy." And Assad said, "Ain't nobody from the United States ever come in and asked me for mercy. Free him." Now, I'm telling you all what time it is. See what I'm saying? I'm telling you what time it is because that's the timing that I read. I didn't do that. We was just back here waiting on them to get back with their mysterious selves. Well, the thrust for equality is tied to the vision of redemption. That's what I've been trying to say in those two stories. You want to hear that again? I really mean that. The thrust for equality is tied to the vision of redemption. And when it's cut off, you got some problems. I don't care what color or which culture you are. Okay? Most of all, I don't care in these days which sex you are. See how that thing is just kind of transcends itself? It affects everybody. All right. And so Langston Hughes and the book The Color Purple and other things like that, all these people are saying the same thing. And I don't want you to miss that because that's an experience of trying to perceive what that's about. I clipped out an article. It came out of the Lutheran Standard. Do you all read that? Yeah. And in this article it says, best source for King's theology, King's Sermons by Jim Cohn. I could read that, but we don't have time. I just wanted to cite that for you. W.B. Du Bois penned a postscript at the end of the book that he wrote entitled The Gift of Black Folk. Have you all read that book or heard of it? That's an excellent book, The Gift of Black Folk, W.B. Du Bois. And here's what he says at the very end of the postscript. He says, "Listen to the winds, O God, the reader, that wail across the whipcord stretched taut on broken human hearts. Listen to the bones, the bare bleach bones of slaves that line the lanes of seven seas and beat eternal tom-toms in the forests of the laboring deep. Listen to the blood, the cold, thick blood that spills its filth across the fields and flowers of the free. Listen to the souls that wing and thrill and weep and scream and sob and sing above it all. What shall these things mean, O God, the reader?" And Du Bois then, in his inimical style, answers his own question when he says, "You know, you know." Now, it seems to me in these lines and in these two little stories that we've shared with you, and in the challenges that certainly King's theology presents, W.B. Du Bois particularly brings us face to face with the central question of all of King's theology. And I think that to me is my reflections as I have studied this. And that is, what is the meaning of the black odyssey in this land? Okay? What is the meaning of the black odyssey in this land? Why are we here instead of there? Has our suffering and our humiliation and our joy served some great, though hidden, purpose? Or did the slaves and the sharecroppers and the martyrs and victims bleed and dream and die in vain? Those, to me, my brothers and sisters, are brutal questions. They are frank questions, and they are dangerous questions. And the person's theology that we'll just take a little peek and open into and see the person whom we now have established as a day of celebration in this country. Little people know that Martin Luther King Jr. was about the most, or so the record states, Martin Luther King Jr. was the most dangerous man in this country. And I didn't want you to, don't ever forget that. That's what the government of the United States has stated and declared. Now that's the person y'all celebrating, so you got to watch out now. So those are brutal questions and dangerous questions. To ask them in this way is enough to take anybody's breath away. The question of meaning haunted W.B. Du Bois. It haunted Martin Luther King Jr. It haunted Malcolm X. It haunted Martin Luther King Jr. And it certainly haunts us today as now then our postscript for just taking a brief gander at some of the things that King has to share with us. Now, that's what, one of my problems is it takes me a long time to open my stuff up, right? So you all on the same train that I'm in now? You ready to go in? All right. I think one of the reasons why it is very difficult to evaluate Martin Luther King Jr. as a theologian is the simple fact that he never published a systematic statement of his theological position. His published works were usually a mixture of autobiographies, reporting the progress of the civil rights movement. Was that book down in the bookstore? Did you all see one of the books of Martin Luther King Jr. down there? Strength of Love is down there. Okay. Well, that, some of you might be able to get a copy of that. But most of his works then report the progress of the civil rights movement and so forth, and the boycotts of 1955 and 56. We mentioned the book Stride Toward Freedom. The Birmingham demonstrations of 1963, Why We Can't Wait, is another book that he wrote. And the events after the March of Selma in 1965, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos Our Community. Another book was The Trumpet of Conscience, and his most important work outside of A Measure of Man was the book Strength to Love. And this is probably one of the most popular books of Martin Luther King's. His sermon collections are there for all of us to read and be strengthened by. The final thing that he did was a tremendous dissertation for his own doctorate degree, and that was a comparison of the conceptions of the thinking of God in Paul Tillich and Henry Nelson Wiman. But in spite of that, then, my little side comment to you is that between Europe and the West, the definition of a theologian is an impressive shelf of books that you author. Now, when you're in a racist institution, it's very difficult to write books if you don't say what the folk want you to say, since they control what is being said. Do you all hear what I'm trying to say now? So it's kind of a double whammy of a sword there. So the question becomes, in Lutheranism, if I write a book, will white folks read it? I said, they probably will, just to see if I'm saying it like I'm supposed to say it. But that's not my definition of what a theologian is. I just want you to know that. And there are a whole lot of other people that don't share that kind of definition of a theologian. It seems to me that meaningful theological reflection can manifest itself in action as well as writing. Now, this is just on the side. I think there are two kinds of theologians. I'm giving you all stuff that most people don't normally get. You can either be a descriptive theologian or a prescriptive theologian. A prescriptive theologian tells folk what they ought to believe. We call those people dogmaticians. Okay? I will tell you what you ought to believe. And that's looking at the historical material and then saying that's what they believe and that's what you ought to believe. You got me there? A descriptive theologian, which is what I count myself as, is I'll sit down and watch you all, and then I will write what you believe and do. You follow what I'm saying? So you can't really be one without the other. In other words, they go hand in hand, but there seems to be a cleavage sometimes between the two. But in the case of King, you know, there's more to a theologian than just that reflective part. I think that the action part is a significant part of the understanding of a theologian. Now, what about the mystery of our times? To speak of Martin Luther King Jr. as being in any way a theologian for our time, I think that the onus is on me, for you, to give you some serious consideration to what in the world I mean by the phrase our time, right? You can't let me get out of here without me telling you what I think I mean by our time. There then is a word which has probably been used more than any other to describe the majority of the problems which have forced all of us into a certain mold of understanding and which has furthermore had many of us face in recent past what we are now being confronted with today. I think it is also a word which gives every evidence of being even more applicable for the future, not just right now, our time, but also for the future. This is so we can understand the mystery of the meaning of our time from the perspective of King. That word that I am suggesting to you that is meaningful in understanding our time has three letters to it, and it's spelled G-A-P, gap. Neither the sociologists nor any of our young people today will let us forget that we live in what's called a generation. You finish it. Yeah. I just want you to know I'm not dreaming this up. See, I'm trying to paint what I think is our time. somewhere in the 60s, I believe, was we had the Kerner Commission report that came out in America. And it suggested that America is being split into two societies, one black and the other white. And it ended the report by saying that the gap, the three letters again, is getting wider. Reference to extremism in America grows more frequent, and language about the new left and the right wingers, it seems to be proliferating at such a tremendous pace that it appears that gap is widening, right? The gap terminology is applicable not only to the American domestic scene, but also this gap terminology we could overlay into the international scene. In spite of talk about the whole Marxist-Christian dialogue and the emergence of talk of convergence and so forth between Marxism and capitalism, there are gaps that are widening even more between this country and the Soviet Union. Would you not agree? Or do you think we're getting closer? Yeah, I think the gap, I'm hanging in here with this word, I think the gap is widening. Even more serious is the widening gap between what we know of as the haves and who else? And the have-nots in the world today. And I think that gap is wide. So this gap between the so-called third world and the more affluent nations has caused some of us to reinterpret, as it were, the Marxist rhetoric and revolution that has appeared in many of our contemporary writings. So rather than seeing the poor or the proletariat within a nation revolting against the rich or the bourgeoisie, they see the poor nations of the world as a new proletariat within the United States and also joining many of the other nations of the world. So the gap between humanity's technology, for example, and humanity's wisdom in the use of this newfound technology is growing wider and wider. Okay? In other words, as we experience more and more technology, we also experience more and more problems with how to use that, right? And that gap is getting wider and wider. There is a significant gap between those who see humanity progressing and those who see humanity on the threshold of reverting back to the Stone Age. Did you all know that we have a big problem with that? There are two big camps about that. If I raise that, we might even have that big fight in here. And that gap would be right. Martin Marty, one of our colleagues in Time magazine, wrote him up as probably one of the most foremost thinkers of our age. He just by accident is a Lutheran. He's quoted as being saying that the modern world can be viewed under the twofold sign of a growing nationality along with a growing existential absurdity. Isn't that something? Yeah. Well, anyway, that's just something to play around. But neither the church nor theology has been immune to the invasion, which is the point for us. We have not been immune to the invasion of this whole gap terminology. Do you all remember when the late Bishop Pike, in announcing his departure from the organized church, accused the establishment of Christianity of evidencing a credibility gap? In case you wonder where that came from, Bishop Pike coined it. You know, he was the first one to coin that. But he said there seems to be a credibility gap. Or we could say there seems to be a relevance gap. Or some people would put it this way, you all, there seems to be a performance gap today. I call it, I call our church as a church that demonstrates tremendous dysfunctional competence. That's what I call it. You might write that down and share with your pastor. Get pitched out of the church. But there seems to be a big performance gap on the part of America today. Furthermore, the gap between God and humanity, which was perceived by even a person like Karl Barth, he's a famous name in Lutheranism, has been so widened by many of the successors that God seems to be, says Karl Barth, have disappeared on the other side somewhere. That is to say, the other side of the gap. So on the basis of that, many theologians, not too many years ago, declared that God was dead. Do you all remember reading books like that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, right. There is one sense in which this gap terminology, which separates God from humanity, is radically different from the various political and sociological gaps that which separate people from people. But as the gap grows between humanity and God, the result is that humanity experiences a sense of loneliness. It experiences a sense of alienation and a concomitant feeling of isolation. And that's why we are keeping the psych department busy today. See? But as that gap then continues to grow, our time is in great need. Now this is the hooker. Our time is in great need, I think now, of a theology which can bridge the gap. See, I really set up a sound intellectual base to discuss this with you. We are in need of a bridge for our time, for these gaps. And I call that, in simple terminology, and you thought I was going to say something brand new, we need a theology of reconciliation today. Isn't that something? A famous and most beloved word of Lutherans. And we are in need of a theology which can help make possible the reconciliation, not only of humanity with God, but of humanity with humanity. And the person who did that better than any other theologian is, guess who? Martin Luther King Jr. No wonder we need to look at Martin Luther King Jr.'s theology. See that? Built you up for a unique understanding of King's theology. So since we are in such need of King, enter King into the room, and we ask King, what's the word? And King would say, Martin is the person that my parents named me because we really like Martin Luther. But Lutherans don't know that we will evangelize Lutheranism all over the world for them. With my name. See, that's we can talk about that too. In case you were wondering, you know, who really is projecting Martin Luther all over the world, it's a little old black person that they attach the King to at the end of his name. But he is certainly one person whose thought and work have made a significant contribution to such a theology of reconciliation in the theological enterprise today. He has made a major contribution to that concern. In doing so, he set for himself a mission involving three tasks, and I put them up on the board. He sought constantly to bridge the gap. See, we're right back on that. King himself sought constantly to bridge the gap between the doctrine of God and human experience. Now, that was his intellectual task. That's a monster, isn't it? You know, you got to be some kind of dummy as a theologian to tackle this one. You know why? Because most theologians don't fool around with this one. We run from that one. Very few theologians fool around with the doctrine of God. Within his own person, he closed the gap. Now, this is an important one. That's the second one here I put up there. He closed the gap between the violent advocacy of change. People want to change, and they want to do it with guns. Not anything you got, kill them. Now, of course, that ain't new to the United States, because that's with precision the way we deal with everybody. You mess with us, and we will kill you. Why else do you think we're spending all that money for all these missiles and the rest of this stuff we're putting together? This is some serious business. So King walked into that thing. And within his own person, he closed the gap between the violent advocacy of change and the nonviolent acceptance of the status quo. Do you all know that's what we're facing ourselves today? Nonviolent acceptance. That's the definition of Lutheranism, if you want a new one for the new church. Nonviolent acceptance of the status quo. Now, that was his moral task. See, we got an intellectual task that King set himself out three tasks to do. That we got it now. We're locking it in. He had an intellectual task. There it is. Now he's got a moral task. There it is. And then one more. His goal was to collapse the distance between a faulty present and an ideal future. Collapse that distance between those two. Now, that was his political task. Boy, I really wish we could get into that stuff, because that is some exciting stuff to study. And some people in here, like Hope, a few of them took this course at seminary, and they are full of wisdom. So if y'all see me and I look tired and I'm thinking, y'all go over there and ask Hope and Cheryl Stewart and some of the rest of these people who took these courses. They'll really fill you in on all this. So I put the heat on them. If they mess up, they know we'll get them when they get back to Chicago. Now, I want to make, we ran out a lot of time, didn't we? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Could I make just one other quick statement, then we can discuss it? The most significant part of what King poses as problematic then, so I can't get into all that, I'm sick of time. Well, one of the most significant things is the his understanding of ethics. Okay? And this is the reality of evil that I want to talk about real briefly. And it's it's a subtitle called The Structure of Evil. That's the way I handle it. What is the structure of evil? Now let me set you up with that, and it'll take me about 30 seconds, not as long. It hardly seems coincidental that the same period of time that theologians announced the death of God, at the same period of time now that they announced the death of God, that a novelist could write about the incarnation of evil in Rosemary's Baby. You all remember that? That wasn't a coincidence in my brain. Remember we talking about the mystery of the mean of our time? Now look at that. Or at the same period of time that a film could come out and scare me half to death entitled The Exorcist. You all remember that one? Yeah, that scared me half to death. Some people still I'm scared to look at it. And all of that stuff captured the imagination of the people in this country at that point of time. So the message from contemporary culture seems to shout that even if people are confused about or have lost hope in God, they are still very much aware of the reality of evil. Now that's my point. That and that's relevant today. Why would he tell us something that happened back there then? Because it's relevant today. If people are confused about that stuff, even if some folks have lost hope in God, God is dead. One thing is for sure, they are convinced about the reality of evil. Yep. You all hear what I'm trying to say? So we right on target with this discussion, aren't we? Dang, I'm right. Well, any lingering optimism that's coming out of the 19th and part of the 20th century about this theological liberalism and all that kind of stuff, that's helpful and happy. But the point of it is that it's there. Now, there's a lot of stuff in here where King talks about that, but here's the point that I want to get to you. And it's a challenge because it's a serious point for me. When we were digging around in this material trying to reflect on this, it came to my attention that Lutherans have some problems with evil, and I can say that because I've been a Lutheran all my life as a baby, and I was taught to have a problem with it. But when I start fooling around with King and the rest of that stuff, then all of a sudden that came to a focus. But here is how it comes at us. Zoroastrianism believes, that's a religion. Okay. Zoroastrianism believes that evil has an eternal origin. Okay. The Christian religion posits, in a peculiar kind of way, that evil has an eternal future. Now, you may say that theologian is wrong, except to say Christian Lutherans and a whole lot of other Christians who aren't Lutherans really don't believe that they can conquer evil. I mean, they really don't believe that. I'm going to tell you that right now. As a matter of fact, they will get mad at you if you say that you can conquer evil. They'll get uptight with you about that. They'll say, well, Jesus, that's not only sociologically untenable, that's theologically wrong. That's what my colleagues talk about. but see, the problem with that to me is that I cannot celebrate Easter Sunday, namely that Jesus has conquered death and the devil, and then go outside and say Jesus didn't do it. I can't function like that. I always say, make up your mind, which is it? And that's why black folk have trouble with Paul sometimes. Paul is so wishy-washy. I'm talking Paul in the Bible. Paul is so wishy-washy sometimes, he will drive you crazy. He'll say crazy things like, well, the good that I would want to do, I never do. And the evil that I don't want to do, I'm always doing. Oh, wretched person that I am. Who should I be? And he said, come on, Paul, make up your mind. See, but then as you keep on reading, Paul really does make up his mind, doesn't he? He said, but thanks be to God who gives me the gift of grace, you know, through our Lord Jesus Christ. But see, we don't function with that. That's why I say we suffer from dysfunctional confidence. We like to play with the, you know, that dualistic, them dialectics like that. Lutherans are great with that. But we like the Gospel of John because John is definitive. In the Greek, he starts off and says, "En harte henologos." You know, you're supposed to do this. I'm probably a theologian, so y'all know. But no, you know, instead, begin. In the beginning was the Word, and John's talking to people, and the Word was God. And he said, "If you don't get it, the Word was God." And then he says, "And this Word was the light of the world." See, but when you read John, it's straightforward. So the Word was in the world. That's what I always say to myself. I always dwell there because most Christians say the Word was in the church. And I said, no. That ain't what that said. See, it said the Word was in the world. And we say, no. The Word is in the church. I said, where did you get that from? That's what I don't even know where they got that from. So I just think this is fascinating. And this is the way King would then, in other words, I'm role-playing how King would deal with that. So King then approaches life, and King says, I know that love can conquer hate. King will say, that's the only game in town. When you wake up in the morning filled with the Spirit, love, joy, peace, understanding, hope, long-suffering, it would take me 2 seconds to make you all as demonic and sick as I am, because you would let me. All I have to do is walk in there and say, you all are a bunch of hunkies. No good nothings. Blah, 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 blah. And you would probably say, hey, and you another one too. In other words, isn't that right? In 30 seconds or less, I can get you as demonic as I am without you perceiving that the game is, shall the demonic conquer your spirit of love, joy, and peace, or shall you be able to conquer man? That's all. That's the only game in town. Not unless you thought it was something else. See what I'm saying? That's all that's going on. So even in your household, women are good at this. I mean, they are really good. Holding on to the Spirit of God. Men cranky, walking there. And she'll say, good morning, dear. And he'll say, what's good about it? Just it's a lovely day and so forth. She's holding on to her stuff, namely the Holy Spirit. Yes. And you know, he's just probing away, getting married, man. So eventually she wins him over. So these are the simplistic things in life, and they get to be translated into bigger things when you get out there. So how else can we understand reconciliation other than this way? That I don't know where we got this other definition that most of us operate with, but it sure, certainly is not the Bible. Most of us believe that reconciliation will occur when we shake hands and get along and be friends. No. I don't even know where y'all got that from. Reconciliation occurs as long as one person is holding it out. It's happening. Now, you may not grab hold, but it's still functioning with power. Okay? Well, how do I know that? God was in Christ. Y'all can finish the rest of that. Reconciling. Not waiting on us to shake hands. You understand what I'm saying? When we were still acting a fool. God was reconciling. The word, that's what that is, what that says. But for some reason, when we bring that down on human level, you know, it's got to be a 50-50 trade-off. I still don't know what the 50-50s are. Okay, so let me just stop there because that's a biggie. This whole structure of evil and how King comes at it is just diametrically opposed to the way I've seen too many other Christians handle that. We theorize that thing so much with just war theories and all the rest of that stuff that now we don't even know what's going on. And I don't know what y'all are supposed to do with Easter, but in the black community, black people walk out of that church understanding, for the most part, black folk now, categorically speaking, they walk out of church understanding that
The resurrection says to me that I do not have to put up with the present atrocities of the day. These people leave the church with that kind of stuff. Y'all believe that? They don't have to put up with that stuff no more. How come you stand up and walk over? Why? Because they can't do nothing to you. Yesterday, when we were in demonstrations, policemen with cock guns and say, you take another step and I'll kill you. So you ain't got that kind of power. Because we can't give it to you. Even if we wanted to give it to you, we can't. Don't ask me to do that. I can't do it. Because God is the one who is in charge of life and death. Why do you want me to think that you can do that? That's why people think we're crazy. Do you understand it? But we still talking about the Bible every day, all day long. What do you think Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did? Nebuchadnezzar said, I want you to play like I'm God. They, the brothers said, we can't do that. Are you crazy? Only God has that kind of power. Well, I'll show you how powerful I am, says King Nebuchadnezzar. I'll throw you in the fire and burn your butt up. That is what he said, isn't it? Yeah. No, we got to talk in the 19th, 20th century. And y'all know he threw him in there. But it was demonstrated unequivocally that that boy was not Yahweh. He was not in charge of life and death. But everybody's doing everybody else like that. I'm in charge of your job. What's behind that is I'm in charge of controlling whether or not you eat, which ultimately means whether or not you live. You think you ain't got that kind of power? I tell people that every day. Especially when they try to play God. Even bishops ain't got that kind of power. Did y'all know that? Say nothing about theologians. They're a bunch of rinky-dinks up there. Starting with yours truly. So yeah, that's why we sit back quiet. But, you know, I'm sure you all have some questions.
Yeah, okay.
They don't have to be questions. You could be a witness. You know, like we say, can I get a witness? Did anybody right here get a witness today? So, yeah, you just say what you want to say. It's something to be caught up in the spirit. It's frightening. It things that King used to call a moral card. You know, if you don't want to, don't be fooling around with that thing if you don't want to get in there. See? Get in there and you're doing strange things. That's another one of those mysteries. Yeah. So it's another one of the mysteries there. Because, the rest of the story of the mystery is that we are under a divine script. God is writing this script. Ain't no theologian writing this one, y'all. And then I'm telling you the reason why God is writing the script, because you get all caught up in it. A side got caught up in the script. Do you understand what I'm saying? Joseph, back to Joseph, now your point, which made me think about that, Hope, is that, you know, I'm positive Joseph didn't know what was going on. Who likes a tattletale? Joseph was telling everything. That's why them brothers were so pissed off. Here come that fool again. He even said about our mamas and daddy that they was going to be bowing down and kissing his ring. You all know that's where the story goes. That is the story. You know, black preachers ought to tell y'all that story in the pulpit, and y'all Lutherans will get the picture. But you know, little bitty old kid talking about, well, guess what, Mother and Dad, I had a dream. You understand? I had a dream. And you all be kissing my hand, so forth and so on. I mean, you know, everybody got all offended upside. But here come the old dreaming through the barn pit and all that kind of stuff. And he did not know, as he went from event to event, and I know his brothers and the rest of them didn't know, that he was under a divine script. Now, how are you supposed to think that somebody that lowly and that icky was supposed to end up being, now listen at this language now, being the president of the United States? You all hear what I'm trying to say? Yeah. It's the most interesting, boy. I tell you, it's just amazing what happens to folk when they with God, see?
A woman in my congregation talks about it. I'm back here in the dark.
Excuse me.
A witness. She describes that experience of the moral corridor as getting on the train. And she said it's just sort of inexorable, and she really has a great fear of it. And I just thought of that when you were talking about getting on board or moving with the spirit or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's also fascinating to me whenever the spirit is around, the spirit has to always quickly reassure us, isn't it? Every time you see that, when angels show up, what's the first thing that they say?
Be not
afraid. That ain't by accident. That's what the moral card, really, that's the moral card. You walk up into this thing, boy, you got to take off your shoes, you're on holy ground. Come on, you know, woe is me, I'm done. Don't kill yourself, don't die frightened. We came to give you some good news and great joy, don't kill yourself. See, that's a real. And we've been running around. I tell people all the time, you better let that spirit alone, boys. And we ain't talking about the Pentecostal movements. We're talking about biblical orientations and understanding about it.